Welcome to a quarter past the 21st century, or whatever that is. 25 years into 2000, I just find that mind-blowing. I don't know about you. Are you off to a good start? Off to a good start? Yeah, I had a dream last night. I fell off my roof, taking down my Christmas decorations. And the fact that that hasn't actually happened makes me feel like my year's gotten off to a really good start. But I am going to send Tammy up this year just to be safe. You know the story about Vince Lombardi when he took over the Green Bay Packers in 1959? They came off of a losing season, and he got the team together, and his first meeting with these professional football athletes, you know this? He stands in front of them. He says, "This is a football." Right? When you've had a bad season, or you're just lost, or you've been doing something for a long time, it's very important to come back to the basics. It's always about the basics. It's always about the small stuff. And the reason that we return year after year after year to our values, our core values, is for those very same reasons, is that we don't want to forget the very basics of what Jesus has asked us to do. Our mission statement is essentially that. It takes the Great Commandment and the Great Commission and puts it in some modern vernacular. Right? Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love others as you love yourself. Go and make disciples." And we say we are a church of worshipful, relational, missional people. It gets a little more than that, but that's the basic premise of it all. We don't want a mission statement to end up just being a placard that's hanging on a wall or a fancy slide on the website. We want to take the core stuff of what Jesus is asked to do and make sure that we're hard at it, right? We're going to put a backdrop on this too, which is the prodigal son story. So for the next few weeks, we'll talk about our core values, we'll talk about our mission statement, and we'll bring the prodigal story of the two sons of the father that were both somewhat egocentric in their places of life. And then we have this father who's very God-centric. And the sons do what the sons do, and the father shows this extravagant grace and celebration and invites them to be at his party, in his home, under his roof and a part of his benevolence, right? So that age old story, we're gonna pull that in. And I would imagine if you have embraced the capacity that is yours to have of being able to look in the mirror, being able to assess yourself on some level, you'll see over time reflections of both of those sons in your own life, as hard as it is to see. But the hope, too, is that you will be seeing and what we will be inspired to do on what we are about as a church is growing into the Father, into the heart of the Father, to see that beginning to emerge and flow out of us as well. You should be able to see all of it. Okay, so here's our mission statement. It's 18 years old, an expression. Like I said, it's reflecting 2,000-year-old words of Jesus, though, and it goes like this. Vista is a movement of worshipful, relational, missional people at the intersection of Jesus and real life. So what do we mean by that? Jesus at the intersection of Jesus and real life. Vista, worshipful, relational, missional at the intersection of Jesus and real life. What do we mean? Well, we're a people who are pursuing God, a God that we understand defines truth and holds us accountable in applying it. We're worshipful. We pursue God. We pursue others, knowing that they, others, are the instruments by which God often uses to mature us and together be a flourishing, beneficial additive to the communities that we live in. This is why we embrace and love one another well. And we pursue, we're missional, those who are far from God or have walked away from God. And we do it respectfully, helpfully, and this word will catch your attention, vulnerably. We'll talk more about that as the week goes on. That should catch your attention. What does it mean to be vulnerable in the way we are reaching for those who are far from God? But that's the kind of people that we are. And we do it the way Jesus taught us to do it and the way he demonstrated it. We do our mission. We be and become the people that God has called us to be and become, and we do it at the intersection of Jesus and real life, the way Jesus does it, humbly, generously, fearlessly, which is pretty much the same as faithfully and consistently, right? We look at Jesus' life, we hear from Jesus, we pursue him, we read about him, we inculcate him, we get to know him, and we allow the Spirit to grow us into people more like him at this intersection of real life. This is the phrase that has been on my mind quite a bit over the last few months. This idea about being at the intersection of Jesus and real life. I've been asked multiple times, why do we put the word real in there? Why not just at the intersection of Jesus and life? Well, it's primarily because we want to be intentional about our understanding that life often, if not always, happens in not the most pretty, wonderful, cute little ways. That it is the actual hard, gritty, complex spaces of life where God is calling us to enter in and to grow up. It is our natural inclination that when things get hard, particularly relationally, we leave. But that's real life, hard relationships. My wife teaches this all the time. When relationships go sideways, welcome to life. Right? That relationships are, by the nature, we're all sinful on different levels. We aren't finished products yet. Two people that aren't finished products yet, that are still working through the sinfulness in our lives, are definitely going to bounce and bang into each other a little bit. It is in those spaces where God calls us and Jesus implores us to stay and understand what it is to be a Christian, what it is to love others, what it is to trust God. So we want to live at that real life space. The psalmist says, search me and know me, O God. Point out, and I'm paraphrasing, all the unsavory ways within me. Like, we believe that God is calling us into real life, into honesty and integrity about who we are and who we aren't, who we are to be. And to be honest about that, to be real about that and authentic about that with one another. Our mission statement reflects the heart of God, the life of Jesus. It shapes not only what we believe, but how we aim to live day by day. Now, I said this real life part of it is what's catching my attention. I want to dig into that a little bit. This kind of, it's challenging to think about this space, and I grow increasingly concerned about the prevailing culture and the shift away from reality. The unhealthiest influences. I'm not saying that the culture is completely, you know, overshadowed and overwhelmed with this idea, but the unhealthiest influences of today's culture redefine reality as abuse and delusions as truth. There are factions of our culture today that are redefining honesty as abuse, criticism as abuse, critical thinking as abuse, authenticity as abuse, and reinforcing the delusions that we embrace as the truth. The intersection, here's the thing, the intersection of real life is increasingly a vacant junction. Are you with me? When we say we want to meet with Jesus at the intersection of Jesus and real life, my concern is there aren't a lot of people there. We're hiding from real life. They're moving into the shadows, and it's difficult to find that kind of raw, real, honest interaction for which Jesus comes to meet us. That's my concern. Concern, maybe I could say it this way. Can the church, can we still actualize our mission statement? Can we still be about what our mission statement calls us to be about? Worshipful, relational, missional people at the intersection of Jesus in real life. Can we still be relevant as a church? How do we remain relevant as a church? Okay, so the reality is these kinds of things aren't necessarily all that uncommon. There's parts of this that I'll get to that I think are uncommon, but it's not uncommon. Today's culture is reflecting very much what we see in the 2,000-year-old story of the prodigal son, right? The younger one comes to the father and says, "Father, give me my share of the estate." That's in Luke chapter 15. "Give me my share of the estate. I want my inheritance." And you think, okay, so he asked his dad for his inheritance. He could just say no, or he could say yes. No. That request in the context of the ancient Near East is tantamount to saying to the father, "I wish you were already gone. I wish you were dead." Just asking for your half of the inheritance, that's what you were saying. I want no part of you. It's not looking for a benevolent early handout. It is saying, "I wish you were gone. I wish you weren't here. I want my part of the money, and I want to live apart from you as though you don't even exist." It's publicly disgracing to the father in the eyes of the wider community. For the son to do that to the father was disgraceful. What he's doing is he's celebrating and honoring his ability to be independent, his desire to be deconstructive of the reality that he was grown up in and the reality of the world that was there to protect him and mature him and send him off. It dismisses and celebrates dismissal of the authorities in life as oppressive. The son's impatience isn't then just a matter of a question about finances. It's a personal rebellion. And it's more than a personal rebellion, it's a communal dishonoring that effectively severed him from the social and relational bonds designed and in place for his safety and his maturation and his guidance. He's severing himself from all of that. Proverbs 14 says, "There is a way that appears to be right, but in the end, it leads to death. In the end, it leads to destruction." And that's what happens. In the middle part of Luke chapter 15, not long after that request, the younger son got together all that he had. He set off for a distant country and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. He left the protective reality of his life to pursue his own reality, and it left him in a deeply painful reality. He was isolated, bereft, dependent, enslaved, and utterly forgotten. Did you catch that last part? When they went out to feed the pigs, there's a guy in the pig pen with the pigs, and they didn't even throw him anything of the food that they were giving to the pigs, as though he wasn't even there. Here's some of today's prevailing cultural dysfunctions it's just a few that have caught my attention. And what is maybe the most disconcerting thing for me. Again, I'm not trying to throw the whole cultural world that we live in aside as utterly worthless. There are significant parts of it and significant people, significant groups of people and numbers of people today that would read the prodigal story, look at the son's decisions and his actions, and categorize them as brave and authentic and necessary for personal growth. The son and go, "Yeah, that's healthy. That's what he should do. That's the best thing for him to do. Here's what we see. I'm not going to go into too much depth here because I think it just will overwhelm you. I've been processing this for quite a bit and have all kinds of thoughts on this. But you can just probably imagine some of these things and understand what I mean. There's a pretty significant degree of celebration of independence. Right? We kind of grow up in that as Americans. The whole experiment was, you know, a declaration of independence. Normalized deception. Do you know what I mean by that? Normalized deception. Political campaigns routinely twist statistics or use misleading narratives. Marketing campaigns do the same thing. And when that happens on a massive scale, it just normalizes that dishonesty. It makes it seem like, oh, that's just the way we do things. Influencers promote products they don't use, don't believe in. Fake news is accepted without critical thought, and it spreads 6 times faster than real news, right? And what happens is we're in this soup that says, oh, this is how life is. Deception is normalized. Deconstruction as a virtue, right? Tearing things down that are arguably, rationally, good things. Everything, nothing's perfect. But many of the institutions we built were built on moral foundations and are there for the purposes of enlightenment and education and instruction and moral guidance. And it's now virtuous to tear those things down. I think everything needs to be criticized. I'm unfortunate for my wife. That's how I'm wired. Everything needs to be seen in a critical eye. Everything needs to be reconsidered. But not just destroyed. You do those things because you're looking for ways to move that situation, that institution, that thing to better. Reconstruction is the end game, not deconstruction. But deconstruction is seen as a virtue. Just tearing something down is just applauded. Emotions, strong emotions, are used as a justification for irrational decisions and actions. Now, it's very hard as humans not to be directed and guided by our emotions. The lion's share of studies today suggest that we mostly do that. We like to think we're rational beings first, but we are actually emotional beings first. We make our decisions, we decide what we're going to believe in with our emotions, and then we use our rational parts of ourselves to justify those. But there's no rational part even jumping in. It's just lots of emotional decisions that are not to be questioned, not to be interfered with. And then there's just straight up just dismissal of authority. Authority is seen as negative and oppressive. Now, I get it. These things that I mentioned, right? Think about this. Celebration of independence, normalized deception, deconstruction, emotional decisions, dismissal of authority. Well, that's just adolescence, right? We've all been there in most of these spaces. It's just a reflection of immaturity and part of the growing up process. You kind of got to sort of stretch your wings. You're trying to, in some ways, I think when we're young, we know we're doing some things wrong, but we're trying to see how far we can get and what kind of pushback is there. And there's a part of me that looks at that and thinks, okay, culture, I shouldn't be so prideful. I shouldn't be so standoffish or judgmental. I was there just in different forms and different ways. The bigger concern, what makes matters worse, is it's becoming exceedingly difficult for today's prodigal to follow through with the prodigal son's story in which the son comes to his senses. It's one thing to sort of walk in the immaturity that is adolescence, but it's another thing to walk in that with dysfunctions that surround you that make it
almost impossible to come to your senses. This is the part I think is incredibly dangerous in today's world. Culture is actively discouraging self-reflection, critical thinking, and it ridicules God construct. And this is what that means. Without insight, you cannot self-correct. If you don't self-correct, you're going to hit rock bottom. And when you hit rock bottom, and if you hit rock bottom, and there isn't any confidence that there is something greater available, a dependable truth to be grasped, an eternal strength to trust in, an accessible peace to obtain, you're left in a very dark, very lonely, hopeless place that is increasingly suicidal. Of course, suicide rates are rising. Of course, mental illness is on a rampant increase. There is less and less ways and possibilities and encouragement for coming to our senses. We all need to come to our senses. Unless the prevailing culture and we've distanced ourselves from anything that allows us to come to our senses. The fear of God, proverbial wisdom goes, is the beginning of wisdom. A proper reverence, awe, and respect for God forms the foundation of true wisdom. A fear and a respect for God is synonymous with humble and willing to hear from greater than myself, whether it's the community that I live in or the God that I serve. Where there is no humility, where there is no capacity, no encouragement, no willingness to see, we don't self-correct. We hit rock bottom, and there is nowhere to go. Paralleling what I've already covered, the dysfunctions that get people lost are these dysfunctions that I think are sort of new. They certainly aren't a part of the prodigal story. He lives in a God context. He understands that there is a father on a plantation, on an estate that likely will welcome him back in some capacity. There is something outside himself that he can go to, and he can come to his senses. The unhealthiest part of today's culture embraces these deeper dysfunctions that not only get people lost, keep them lost. I'll just hit a couple of them. I've mentioned some of them already. The decline of self-reflection. A Harvard study found that people spend 40% of their waking hours thinking about something other than what they're doing. Constant distractions make solitude and reflection a pretty rare thing. Boredom is intolerable and avoided, but almost always the beginning of introspection and creativity, right? Boredom is the pathway to introspection and creativity. Daily mindfulness practices are replaced by mindless practices at your fingertips. Decline of self-reflection. Echo chambers and self-validation. You've heard this. All this stuff. Algorithms reinforce existing beliefs. They limit exposure to challenging perspectives. 60%, 65% of Americans know that social media creates tribalism, which creates division, which means you know that social media and the way that is all designed causes you to be in groups of people that think alike, act alike, and reject and distance themselves from anybody different than themselves. And not just distance, but judge and reject. News outlets don't do what they were originally designed to do, which was be the watchdog of falsehood. Now they cater to specific biases and do very little critical thinking. Okay, here's another huge one in today's world, the avoidance of pain and discomfort. I just wonder when somebody is going to finally realize and start to promote the idea that young people in particular are in a lot of pain and discomfort from avoiding pain and discomfort. Pain is the indicator light of a problem. Pain is one of the best indicators and one of the best prompts to look at yourself and go, what's wrong? But all of our media platforms curate joy-filled narratives and avoid discussion, discussions of struggle. Substance abuse rates are rising, and substance abuse is a pain and discomfort avoidance tactic. Trigger warnings, which are a real thing. It is a real psychological thing to be triggered by traumatic past, but it's expanded to the point of being triggered by uncomfortable discussions. Everything is kind of rotating around this idea of avoidance of pain and discomfort, which we get. How many in the room? This is a quick little survey. If you could avoid pain and discomfort, would you? Bing! Right? Loss of moral and communal anchors. Where does moral structure and moral accountability come from? Always. Relationship. Authentic relationship. We need others to go, hey, right? He's talking to you. Right? Look at yourself. We distance ourselves from the relationships that would bring challenge and accountability. We lose our moral and communal anchors. And then you've got this whole thing, it's very complex, is this whole idea of curated identities. Right, just look around in the world and you will see people creating and developing, trying to mold their own identity, not from some stuff within, not deeper character, but what people see. And a fabricated identity is protected by superficial relationships, right? If you've got an identity that you're trying to sell, that you're trying to reinforce, that you're wanting people to buy into, you can't allow anybody to get too close to you, or they'll see that it's not true. So all the curated, all the ways that we're creating identities without real relationship end up creating very superficial communities that are of no help to us when it comes to the desire and the need to be brought to our senses. All right, summarizing. It's very difficult. I find it, on some level, apart from faith, scary. Very difficult for a modern prodigal to come to their senses, like what happens in the parable. Without moments of reckoning, without a safe, strong, merciful place to return to, modern prodigals are at risk of being lost indefinitely, unable to find their way back to the Father's embrace. Welcome to 2025. This is my inspirational first of the year message to you. I hope you're excited. Now, I'm not saying all this to be a discouragement. I'm saying it because we want to start our year sober-minded about why we're here. What are we doing? We want to invigorate our missional heart. Platform is burning. We cannot afford to be lulled to sleep. The church is more important now than maybe it, I shouldn't compare. It's always important. And we need to see how important it is in our day, in our time. Big question. I've asked it already. I'm asking it again. Can today's church, can we do anything about this? Yeah, absolutely. Always. It's why the church exists. This is God's work, man. He specializes in bringing dead stuff back to life. Lost things, blind things. We just need to get after it. The Spirit of God can move in the midst of all this stuff. We just need to get to the right place. All the hard decisions, all the sacrifices that we've made over the past 5 years as a church have been for the exclusive purpose of improving our relevance and our reach. The goals we've set for the next 3 years have modern prodigals at the center of our mind and deep in our heart. The hub is designed as a physical, real intersection. And we want to increase the traffic flow through here however we possibly can with those who need to see and experience something beautiful and something good. The kingdom of God is always advancing. The gospel's edge penetrates this world. And it advances and it penetrates through yours and my commitment to follow Jesus and our commitment to do it together. We say, I'm a follower of Jesus. Maybe you say that. It is the idea of being a disciple of Jesus is to follow him. Well, it seems like that's an easy thing to do, just follow him. Yeah, unless you pay attention to where he's going. You remember in Luke 11 when he's walking along and says this large crowd was following and he turns around, and I'm paraphrasing dramatically here. He turned around and said, what are you all following me for? You must not understand where I'm going. Where Jesus is going is not easy places. It's not comfortable places. It's not always happy places. Jesus is leading us where people need him, and he wants us to go with him. So our role is to be prayerful, sacrificial, generous, courageous, and ask God, where are you going we want to follow? Equip us, train us, develop us, deepen us to do your work in the hard spaces of life. We need to put down our lives just like he did for the sake of those within our spheres of influence. So it starts this way, and I'm going to do this very briefly because we're going to get into it in the next couple of weeks. Number one, admit to the reflection of those sons in our own lives. Right, we need to see that we do have a tendency to abandon and distance ourselves from the things and the people that are most corrective in our lives. And if we don't do that as much, what we do is we leave those things without leaving those things, and that just means we sort of live in this prideful space where we put on that we've got it all together, but really we don't like what's going on. In some ways, we are those sons in different ways. Our tendency to wander away from God, allured by the shiny things of the world, or sit in judgment of those who do wander, right? Both are problems. Here's a couple good quotes of some guys I've been reading lately. John Mark Comer and Andy Crouch. Is one of Comer's quotes. Coming home is more than geography. It's a posture of the heart, a return of God's presence where we find healing for both our desire to go after the shiny things to fill our needs and our hidden resentments, right? You can see both of the sons in that, right? He says, look, that we all need to understand the need to come back to the gracious, merciful presence of God for forgiveness and healing in those spaces. We have to start there. This is great from Andy Crouch. A community that cannot risk welcoming the vulnerable, a community that cannot take the risk of welcoming the vulnerable, the outsider, the wanderer, is a community that's lost sight of its own vulnerability. Only when we recognize, this is, you can bank on this one, you can kind of get it on this, only when we recognize our own need do we extend true hospitality. The reason we need to keep recognizing how the sons are in us, and, you know, to look at that in our own life, is because if we don't, we can't really do the work that we need to do to welcome others that have, that are the same. So we need to admit to those things. And then the next thing we need to work on, we want to continue to be about, is to be a community that's shaped by the Father's heart. This Father, his compassions were boundless and his celebrations were confounding. It is like it was beyond the pale. The culture would say he shouldn't have done it, that he had been dishonored and been cut off, and he should have disciplined rather than accepting back. But he was boundless in his compassions. While the boy was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, filled with compassion for someone who rejected him and dishonored him publicly, had compassion for him. When you look around in your world, whether it is within your own, under your own roof, within your own family, within your neighborhood, within your associations and spheres of influence, I know, like me, you see people that are just at least frustrating and at the most and disappointing and hurtful. And the question is, can we see what's happening in their soul? Can we see how they've been led astray, how they've been deceived, how the culture has hurt them and put them at a disadvantage? Can we see what's really going on there and have some compassion? And he ran to his son. He threw his arms around him. He kissed him. And he said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. We're going to talk about this as the weeks come. These are the habits and the character qualities we need to continue to embrace and allow to be grown up in us by the Spirit. Attentiveness, initiative, compassion, generosity, invitation. These are all parts of the Father. James K.A. Smith says this, worship doesn't just express what we believe. It forms us into people who learn to see each other, even the other son, with the Father's eyes. True God worship means being formed into a community that embraces both the repentant prodigal and the resentful older sibling, just as the Father did. Prodigal story is a radical invitation to a homecoming feast that's open to anyone who recognizes the need. It can be scary to come home. It can be scary to humbly admit you were wrong. And it can be scary to guess, estimate how the welcome is going to go or not go. But God's arms, illustrated by the Father's arms, are wide open, wide open. In the midst of a world brimming with judgment, polarized in its opinions, anxious about who's in and who's out, Jesus paints a picture with this story of love that can heal our deepest divisions. The miracle is the Father's scandalous celebration, one that invites every last prodigal and curmudgeon among us to sit and dine at the table of grace. So these are the questions that are in my head right now that I'd like to put in your head. Is our intersection of Jesus in real life a compelling place? Is our community, our work, our parties, ones that the sons and daughters that are lost want to be at? Is our worship personally demanding? Are our relationships unbreakable? Does our mission require courage? Is our hope relentless our gratitude exhaustive, our generosity fearless? Are our priorities foolish looking? Is our hospitality risky? Is our peace perplexing? There's nothing more hurtful to the gospel, right? Jesus said, this is the good news. There's nothing more hurtful and more frustrating for me when the news that we have or the spaces that we offer aren't good. It's supposed to be good news. It's up to us that it's good, that they look at us and this place and go, I'd actually rather try that. And that's not easy. That is not easy, church. Because we're working upstream, too, because people have already decided it's not a good place to be. That's why they're not here. So I want to be encouraging to you because I think you are amazing. And I think God has postured us for some amazing stuff in 2025. I think, I pray, I hope we can be the kind of place that God needs us to be. Can save some, bring some, welcome some that would otherwise be lost forever. I think God wants to do some amazing things. Start by praying. Get your blessed 10 list out. Pray for 10 people that are far from God and look for opportunities to listen. Listen, as you go into this year, know that the same celebration that we see in the prodigal story, you take the invitation and courageously extend that invitation to others. And let's be the community where no one is left outside the party.